we've spent a lot of time as a collaborative group talking about the topic of identity, and that in a lot of ways is actually the centerpiece of what we're trying to unearth to some degree. And so far what we've come to conclude, and one of the things that unites us together as a group, is our shared interest in how identities come to be at all. What it is that identity actually is, how identities are things formed by social groups rather than things that one is essentially born with or one naturally has, and what actors and what social forces come to play in creating that very identity. So in order to give a little bit of life to this and to try to figure out to some degree how that process works, we've got to take seriously not only the fact that that people in their everyday lives have certain images of each other, and that to some degree creates certain labels of classification, which then gets slapped onto people, and that's one way that identity is created. But as a group, we're also interested in how scholars perform the very same act. In other words, as long as you're human, you are making identities, and you're a part of the identity construction process. So despite the fact that we often approach scholarship as a realm that's more descriptive rather than prescriptive, according to some of the philosophical terms that we're buying into, there's really no such thing as a truly descriptive realm that does not also, at the same time, prescribe. Are we all comfortable with that idea? Okay. So we had talked about this example of the student who approaches us and says, "So, Dr. So-and-so, what religion are you?" and how that's a very uncomfortable thing for many of us to answer or to approach. And there are many reasons why that is, but I suspect that it's the same sort of identity politics cooking that informs part of our problematic response to that.
Especially since it's usually the first day of class.
Yeah, or the very last day of class. Right. When the conclusions are supposed to be drawn and everything is supposed to be supposedly summed up, which I think is not by accident. What else do you think about that?
So I think that, I mean, in terms of religion, I think religious studies scholars, and maybe I'm stretching here, but I think religious studies scholars disproportionately get asked that question, mm-hmm. not only by students, but by colleagues in other departments. Mm-hmm. And I think it's ludicrous in some way, because I also ask my students, and so like other people, I don't answer that question, and I also ask the students back, well, when you're in your political science classes, do you ask the professor, mm-hmm. are they political? Or when you are in your sociology classes, do you say, are you social? Trying to get them to think about what that sounds like when we replace words with other words.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they ask political science, Monica? Professors that, do you think?
No, but I think they probably try to ask similar things, maybe by using different language, perhaps. So are you...
They still want to...
How do they vote, right? Right.
Well, so what Miranda just said, I think, is a good indication also of both Miranda and Monica, of why it is that certain identities are important to know and other identities just don't seem to be that important, right? So we were talking earlier about how no one cares, probably, that I am petite, and that I, which is right, the nice word for short, and that I have blue-green eyes, and that I really like chocolate. Those are not things that to my students mean anything at all, right? They're just these quote-unquote neutral descriptors. But asking the question, what religion are you, is one of those things that implies certain meanings that they can then attach to me that will then shade how I'm interpreted by them and how my identity is constructed in turn. I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect that a lot of my political scientist friends probably do maybe sometimes have students who approach them and say, so are you a Democrat? And might ask those things, but that's only because I think of the weight of identity labels that are given in our culture. Now, I doubt that many of my friends who teach history have students who approach them and say, what do you think about the War of 1812, right? That's not the same, that doesn't have the same sort of weight behind it, and there's a reason. Right?
When I've taught classes in gender studies, I do get asked the question of what kind of feminist am I? Mm-hmm. You know, they'll sort of assume, some of them will say, you know, are you a feminist? But then, you know, I mean, if that's kind of taken for granted, then they'll start kind of pushing that. Well, are you one of those feminists who thinks this or that?
Well, is there anybody who answers that question forthrightly?
I don't.
I'm not sure forthright answer is really possible for me, at least, because it's too complicated to boil it down to a label. And that becomes one of multiple reasons to avoid answering it, because whatever I would say would be understood in ways far beyond what I intend or how I see myself.
Yeah, my concern is similar to yours, Stephen. I think that I believe that the students have a set of ready-made stereotypes and narratives to slot me into depending on what identity I say I am. If I say I'm Christian, they'll project a lot of stuff on me. If I say I'm agnostic, they'll project stuff on me. Well, actually, they probably don't know what agnostic means. If I say I'm atheist, they'll project things onto me, and they'll spend the rest of the semester saying, oh, he's only saying that because he's blah, blah, blah. And in fact, even if they knew what my identity was, they would still most likely slot me into a narrative that doesn't really fit the narrative I would tell about myself. So therefore, I hide that information from them. And I actually say that. I say, I don't tell you because you'll project stuff onto me that I don't think is true.
Well, and I think, Craig, what you're saying makes quite a lot of sense, because labels and identity, I mean, they are by definition oversimplifications. I mean, that's, I think we've agreed so far in our conversations that that's one of the most basic things that we can establish, is it whether we're talking about scholarly work or whether we're talking about the interactions that we have with people in the street, labels do function to a great degree in stereotypical fashion, and they oversimplify identity, and I think that's a major reason why, you know, many of us try to side skirt that question. And labels are political too. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to answer that question because I don't know how that will jive with the politics of the administration at the place that I work sometimes.
Right.
I don't have any overt fears about that, but I don't know. And I realize that the label itself, while it may be tremendously oversimplifying, and while others in charge know that, I don't know that I'm ready to face the politics of that meaning.
Sometimes they've thought that I'm deflecting, or they'll assume that I'm deflecting when I think that I'm being very direct. I don't say, I'm sorry, I cannot answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, I think, kind of directly and quickly say, well, what do you mean when you ask that question? And when you ask that question, I'm not sure that what you're talking about when you say the word religion is necessarily the same thing that I mean when I say that word religion, and we'll talk about that through the course of the semester, and here's how we'll complicate that, da-da-da. But often that is seen as a kind of scholarly skirting.
A dodge.
Yeah.
Do you think students see that? Do you think they're satisfied with that answer?
Often not. No. I mean, often not.
Well, one of the authors that we've been talking about in some of our discussions is Jean-François Bayard, and he suggests that one way of looking at cultural identities is that it's an essence that works itself from the inside out and determines the behaviors of practitioners who share that identity. And I assume that most of us here do not agree, or we agree with Bayard's critique that mm-hmm. that's not really how identity works. But that's often how my students think identity works. And one anecdote along those lines is that one semester I taught this course, my university offers a Religions of the West, where I have to cover Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And the students, about three-quarters of the way through the class, determined that I was Muslim. And this is how they determined that I was Muslim, was because I was very critical of Judaism, and I was very critical of Christianity, and they viewed me as being slightly less critical of Islam. Huh. So that must have meant that I was Muslim. My Muslim identity causes me to treat the material in mm-hmm. fundamentally different ways, so that identity is working itself out in the way I present the material. I told them there are many other reasons why I might treat the material in disparate ways that are alternate, but they did not believe me. They're absolutely certain that I'm Muslim.
I like, too, that you have to fit into one of the categories that you discuss.
Oh, yeah. It can't be something else.
Right. It has to be one of these options that we're going to cover in this unit.
This notion of expressing your identity, like, I'm interested in what everybody thinks about the meeting that we're at. So, at least the American Academy of Religion side, maybe the Society of Biblical Literature, too. Like, I assume we've all been to these meetings enough that we have a sense of what the majority of our colleagues think mm-hmm. when they talk about identity. Because Bayard isn't talking about identity, right? He's talking about identification as a series of practices and strategies that create it continually. In the very asking the question, there's something happening. So we are surrounded by colleagues who talk about, Miranda, you talked earlier about some of the work you're looking at. they're expressing a religious religious feeling, religious mm-hmm. identity, mm-hmm. And that verb, it's not insignificant. Right. Or that verb, you know, to press out from the out from the inside mm-hmm. out. So is that what does everybody think? Is that what's going on at the AAR? Is it unfair to characterize it that that's their model of identity?
I've seen that at the AAR a lot, especially in terms of or in the context of scholars who identify themselves as anthropologically motivated or doing a certain kind of descriptive ethnographic work, because the subjects that they discuss or their object of study is something that they distinguish pretty clearly from their own academic motivations, and in that sense, there is the people with identity are those people I'm talking about. I am removed and somehow in splendid isolation from something called identity. I get to stand back and watch it and talk about it, and so then I become some kind of academic Jane Goodall instead of someone who is also expressing my own interests and someone who has my own politics as I'm discussing the piece of data that I want to talk about.
Yeah, I think one of the ironies of the now fairly widespread nature of the widespread education most of us get on postmodern thought, and I should say widespread and very brief, is the notion we're all taught that to be to be objective, to be purely objective, is an utter impossibility, and so we know and accept this, and so. I'm always intrigued by the way that so many scholars start their work, which is to lay their own identity politics on the table, or what they perceive to be their own identity politics, and to think that so long as I tell you that I am a white female in her late 30s who has such and such other characteristics, that I've appropriately situated myself so that whatever comes next is going to be objective. And if we include scholars, because they are humans, if we include scholars as a part of those humans who make the labels, right, then those humans who have political interests, and still those humans who, because humans can't suspend their political interests, really, and that might be another topic we actually want to address. I think we are often told that there's a way that we can really approach things from a purely objective angle or from a degree of objectivity that is good enough because it's preserving otherwise positive social values or whatever it's working towards. And I think that we sometimes get some scholarship that's really undergirded with a lot of, I don't want to call them faulty presumptions, but presumptions that go unspoken, let's put it that way. I don't know that the logic behind them is faulty, but they simply become invisible. Mm-hmm. And things that I write about a lot have to do with how kind of liberal political thought very, very easily bleeds into studies of conservative Protestants, and the often more liberal progressive scholars writing about these conservative Protestants may say at the beginning of their book or the beginning of their work, hey, listen, here's where I'm coming from, just so you know. But it's almost as if then that the judgments and the value calls made on how to analyze that group at the end of the book, it almost sits in detached fashion from that.
Well, they don't even have to defend why they're studying fundamentalists.
No. Right.
Right? It's just self-evident that these people are curious and need to be studied
right.
somehow.
Right.
And not necessarily explained away or something, but mm-hmm. they just are so obviously interesting. Right. Because
right?
isn't a lot of your work, some of your work, interested in how scholars are using that category, not just how it's a self-designation, but how scholars are using it of a certain temperament
right.
to create their object of study in a certain way. Right.
Right. Well, here's a great example of this. So scholars have over time, and a little bit less so today, but this still comes up, will describe the Christian right and many politically active engaged evangelicals as militant, and they will describe the policies of the Christian right as militant. They'll describe the last 20 to 30 years of from the Moral Majority to the Christian Coalition, from all the various incarnations of different political groups in this way. If militant means something like stands firmly by one's position and is unwavering, it's really ironic that we never hear the National Organization of Women
As militant. Unless you listen to Rush Limbaugh.
I was just
going to
say,
right-wing radio.
Right. But the description of Rush Limbaugh is already that he himself is so militant that his ability to gauge militancy is thereby defeated.
Right.
And so, and again, this is not to say that I'm agreeing here with one or the other, but it's to reveal how the rhetoric operates. Mm-hmm. So long as I can, you know, put you into this particular place and define you in a particular fashion, I can define myself out of the category and over here to a realm of acceptability. And
something that comes to mind while you're talking about the term militant is I wonder if anybody ever calls the U.S. military militant, and my guess is probably not, because calling someone militant, what's embedded in that is the implication that it's illegitimate militancy. Mm-hmm. But if it's legitimate, or if it's viewed as legitimate, we don't have to label it as such. That's just being a hero or something.
There's
like
use of force in either case.
I was just
going to
say.
Yeah. One's legitimate, one's illegitimate.
Yeah,
we don't think one should belong, that force should belong to one of the groups, but it has every right to belong to a, the other.
I know people who will talk about certain religions working towards establishing civil society, and that's not political. Mm-hmm. It's the same. But groups who work to achieve interests that run counter to the liberal democratic nation state, those are now political forms of action. It's the same. It's all politics, then, mm-hmm. we can say. Mm-hmm. Just some are judged legitimate or illegitimate, my interests, your interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think part of the interesting critique to me in thinking about identity politics is who gets identified at all, right, if we want to put it in that way. Because, here's another little thing I was looking at the other day in the context of that project. If and this is very scientific, but if one goes to Amazon.com and if one types in Christian right, evangelicals, fundamentalists, right, and all the different monikers that we could slap on to describe either conservative Christians or politically active conservative Christians, any of those keywords, you'll find a bazillion books. If you type in liberal Protestant, like seven. I'm exaggerating a bit here, but not much. When you do find those, you're recommended to view these other books that these other people have purchased on things like civil society and how American democracy works. And while again, I'm not trying to make some sort of complex argument about the algorithms that run Amazon.com, it is very interesting to see how. I think it's probably fair to say the things that often, to some degree, define or that we believe define the contours of the social project are the things to which we give attention, and the things that are so natural and so embedded in how a culture understands itself don't need to be discussed because they are so embedded.
Yeah, the very scholarly choice of what constitutes an object of study is that choice itself is. Back to Bayard, is constitutive of a very particular kind of social world that finds certain things curious for certain reasons. What you've made me think, though, is to go back to our very original point of entry, the student who comes up after class to find out what religion you are. Like, we're talking about scholars now, right? Their identity and de-identifying, whether they confess their identity. So it's an interesting moment then, because we're the data in that case. Like, the tables have been turned, right? And we're resisting their attempt to identify us for our purposes, mm-hmm. because we fear being.
Right.
But normally we are the identifiers, right? We're the ones naming people fundamentalists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is there an irony there? Are we trying to have it both ways, or?
We know more than our students, and so it's not problematic.
Yeah. There were scare quotes there and
that's right.
It's a legitimate choice based on our authority.
Right.
Like, I mean,
don't question it. Right. Yeah.
When it comes to the classroom, right, we have authority over naming our students in certain ways and seeing their identities. I can look up on the online registration system, see all the students who are registered for my classes, see some of their identification information. They can't access that from me. We can see their pictures.
Yeah.
In our system. Oh, nice.
Yeah, we can
from
too.
their cards, right? Their ID cards. Mm-hmm. And we all, that's not reciprocated because the education system has awarded authority to professors in the classroom that's reserved for them, presumably for reasons that the universities think are legitimate, but could, of course, always be called into question.
I think, like, the ways that we worry about how students will view our own self-identification, if we were to make that explicit, we don't look at it in terms of the way we, as a field, often generalize about other identifiers. And this is a part of the project I'm working on now, in terms of people who even critique the discourse on world religions and the construction of Hinduism and Buddhism and all of these different categories, sometimes within the same word, then apply the term Buddhism uncritically, as if it is this thing outside that they can talk about in a very general fashion, but they've just said, talked about how it was constructed as historical. And so there seems to be that type of disconnect in our research often, because the discourse that we utilize, or the structure of the AAR with the different sections, reinforces a kind of reified, simplistic notion of identity and tradition.
Okay, what drives me nuts about the category stuff, critique, because one of the themes I think we'd all agree we're working on is trying to problematize scholarship that presents itself as a very progressive and ironically reinscribes a very traditional notion of identity, right? There's this irony in a lot of work. And is it scholars who critique the notion of this or that, like you said, Stephen, Hinduism, and they say it's a British colonial invention, and they can chart the history, and they try to dispel the category, but the rest of the book is still on Hinduism. In other words, they naturalize the discourse so effectively that Hinduism is a real thing in the world. It has real boundaries. We know what it is and what it isn't. And the problem is simply what it, quote unquote, you know, what it is being called. And I find that very problematic, this highly philosophically idealist distinction between concepts and practices, between words and things we do. It seems to very effectively naturalize that, whereby the discourse on Hinduism works better than ever when the term's not there. No?
Are you saying that in the context, Russ, you mean where there are token statements inserted, let's say at the beginning of an essay or book, that say, we recognize the construction of such and such, here are the historical threads that have informed that construction, here are the political demands that have informed that construction, and now let's go talk about it?
I think works which try to do that very systematically and thoroughly, and they don't take seriously that the discursive it they're talking about is not a product of the word Hinduism, right? Mm-hmm. The word Hinduism stands in for an elaborate set of assumptions and practices and institutions. It's a big iceberg below the term. And they think it's all but the term, and they fail to realize that it's actually the term and the iceberg of concepts is actually constitutive of the discursive object. So thus, if they're taking the discourse critique seriously, there's no longer any Hinduism to be talked about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a bunch of people doing stuff, mm-hmm. but now we don't know where this stuff and that stuff ends, mm-hmm. and we have to come up with some new management technique to name, because we can't study it all. But they don't take that very seriously, so we know there's Christians out there, or we know there's Protestants out there, or we know there's, you know, there's these local indigenous categories that represent local indigenous fights. We are this, you are that. And we as scholars just simply pick these things up and use them as natural objects. Mm-hmm. And then when we do the critique, we still naturalize the object, and we just try to call it another name. Yeah. We still know we can study Christians. We just call them something else.
And we can't get away from the terms, because the terms are not just, whether it's religion or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever, we can't get away from them because people are using them as self-identifiers, using them to identify other people, but too often we use them as if there's some real essence out there mm-hmm. that we assume we can get to, whether we use the term or not, without thinking of seeing the term as a political choice that people are making when they self-identify or identify others.
Well, and then by extension, Stephen, I think then that we privilege and authenticate and legitimize an insider or participant viewpoint that as some kind of authentic definition or thing. So if you call yourself this, then that this becomes real for me because I'm the scholar going to respect the way that you talk about this thing that you're doing because you're the one who's really doing it. And you're the one who really has some kind of expertise or authority to talk about it.
And it's often a very particular form of the discourse of what Hinduism is that we authorize as the real Hinduism. I've had to see people talking even about some of my work on Sindhi Hindus saying, well, they may say they're Hindu, but, and this is a scholarly peer review, but they're not, they may be wrong about what they are.
Yeah.
Because there's a particular definition of Hinduism and separation between Hinduism and Sikhism that has become the dominant discourse, and that just gets naturalized within the academic literature.
So back to Bayar, the problem then seems to be that so many scholars are taking the result of a series of historical practices as a natural object, and starting from the end instead of the start would be, how was that thing made in the first place?
How is it made in the first place, or how is it made now, remade, continually made now, in terms of the choices people are making to say, we are Hindu, we are not this, or they are not Hindu, there's something else. And we're just, we ignore that process of the choices people are making because we ignore the history of the development of the term.
Yeah. And I'll just add on to that. I think there's also an expectation across fields regarding the role of the scholar too. So Marinda, you hinted at this in the workshop, the Sorad workshop the other day. So, you know, what are we to be doing? Are we to be activists, right? Because I feel like in African American religion, which is one of the areas that I happen to teach, I'm often asked and charged by senior scholars, how do you locate yourself? And what are you doing with this work, right? So they want, say, for example, the signifier blackness to work in two ways. They need it to be a social construction to show that it's a product of white supremacy, but they also need it to have a materiality to it to show that it does something very real. People die, right, because they're black, so you can't erase the subject in your work. So, you know, what are your ethics and how do you locate yourself in this discourse? And, you know, can you really sort of make a postmodern kind of critique about the subject when we just got subjectivity and you want to now erase it? So raising this, right? And we can say that about women categories. So identity politics, the role of the scholar, and the kinds of questions that the field ought to be asking.
One of the questions that was asked in the description of that workshop that you're mentioning was, because this was a group of self-identified, you know, critical theorists, analytic thinkers, and they were talking, it was the question of, even if we can't approach or access objectivity, capital O, in the way that the philosophers would have us think, is that to suggest that all claims or all approaches to this or that study are on the same level? And the implication was that we still have a better way. We scholars can figure out a better way to approach this or that. We've got the kind of suggestive move that if we just figure this out, if we just unlock this analytic secret, then we know how to really talk about identity.
I wanted to go back to, well, I think that part of the reason why these perhaps naive constructions of identity can persist in the academy is not just because people are dumb, but also because
not just.
Although that's part of it, right?
I mean, I'm often dumb myself, so I'm including
some of my best friends are dumb.
But also infrastructural inertia, that you can't get a job studying things that don't exist. You have to get a job studying Hinduism.
Right.
And I don't teach jobs on things that don't exist. I teach classes or on religion.
People teach
the
on
West.
The free market in the economics.
Yeah.
Right.
But
2008 we realized there's no free market.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. The there's an infrastructural inertia that people's careers are tied to these identities, that even knowing that they're fictions, I have to play this game to succeed in my career. So it serves my interest to perpetuate them in the short term, and oftentimes that means perpetuating them in the long term as well.
Yeah. And I think in a related fashion to that, Craig, I think one of the big questions that I think scholars have to really grapple with is, okay, so I got my job because I've got this label, and I apply this label in my scholarship. I am intelligible to others to the degree in my scholarship that I apply these labels. So how can I actually discuss the politics of identity formation unless I use these labels? I think that a lot of the things that we talk about in here are deeply important, but they do expose that catch 22 that we've got, which is, I think all of us have seen this in our own fields, that, you know, adding an S onto the end of the word doesn't fix it, right?
Right.
Going from Hinduism to Hinduisms.
But why do you think so many people think that does fix it? A lot of people think that's a really sophisticated move. I hear a lot of very good scholars. There is no Judaism. There is no Christianity.
Right. Yeah. Well, in my mind at least, what I think that they think it does, and perhaps I think maybe at one point this was a rather logical assumption, is that by making something that was once singular now plural, it erases the notion that there is a monolithic entity. And but it's still, in my mind, and here's why it's, to me, not the best move, it creates still an essentialism, but it just says that the essentialism is diffused into more places.
Yeah.
But yet, the fact that we can, you know, begin to label this group with C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N-I-T-I, I mean, that we can do that means that there is still this sort of core essence to which we can reference.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's be honest. I mean, the reason why things have labels in the world is typically because they have certain similarities or certain differences. And so the basis of categorization is that we're uncovering those things and then that we're able to...
Uncovering or creating?
Right, well, it's creating, right. That we are creating those distinctions. What I was going to say is that we uncover them, but we only uncover what we were first looking for.
That's the thing. I think to the catch-22 that you're referring to, Leslie, I think that's only... it's a catch-22 if we think that using the labels is indicative of identifying a thing that is existing already in the world that we are locating and pointing to and saying, aha.
The discourse of it is already there.
That's right.
Yeah. A thing independent of labels itself.
So I'm using all sorts of codes and categories and labels and things just to have this conversation with you. But it is my we're sharing this code and we're working on, we're playing this kind of language game together in order to give order to this untidy system.
Mm-hmm.
This is Mary Douglas, right? So the labels and the classifications are not about these things that exist in this way, and so we are recognizing their essential intrinsic identity that groups them together. If I understand, yeah, I'm using categories, yeah, I'm using labels, but there's no essential stopness to the color red.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just agreeing to play that game because I don't want to get hit in the intersection.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to a question you asked, Russell, about what does the S do when we make something plural? So in my experience in the area that I teach, what it does is it's also a protection, sort of a protectionist strategy. So if I say the Black Church is a highly homophobic institution, they'll say, well, you're talking about the Black Church as a monolithic entity. And in this case, it actually helps me to build my case and the point that I want to make. So you have to talk about it in terms of Black churches. Don't you know there are a wide variety of Black churches?
So rhetorically, it functions as yes, but.
Yes,
you're right, but there's all these, it's a little
right. So
there.
What Black church are you talking about? Jeremiah writes, Trinity United Church of Christ, or Creflo Dollars megachurch. There are two different things going on.
So having it both ways means there's, on one level, there's uniform identity being presumed, and on another level, there's a multiplicity being presumed so as to avoid the quote-unquote illegitimate form, right?
So Creflo's church has to respond to your critique, but Jeremiah Wright's church, and I'm just using these as examples, his church is outside of the realm of your critique because he's prophetic and the other one is an evangelical megachurch. Right?
And I think that and the move you just made, Monica, kind of goes back to Miranda's point about playing the language game, and because we use the labels, we use the categories, how can we do it and point that out, that this is the Black Church as somebody constructs it. And that becomes, I think, the move that gets left out in a more simplistic.
And here's where it's a catch-22 for me, though. Like, say, where I struggle is that, and I mentioned this the other day, Miranda and Craig, when I teach African-American religion, I pick on it a lot because it's the easiest example for me. I often have to homogenize and talk monolithically, and then I also have to play the S game, Russell. I have to add that S because students come in the class assuming there was one civil rights movement, right? There's one black experience, the black experience, and I say, well, Bayard Rustin's experience,
right,
or Martin King's experience,
right,
or James Baldwin's experience,
right,
or, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer's experience. Not that they're unique, but there are different set of questions involved from those vantage points. So I also play that game myself to, you know, provide a different set of questions, I think, that I think are important.
Yeah, and I think playing the game, as long as you're recognizing or pointing out that you are playing a game and this is, I'm constructing it right now for these ends.
Purposes.
Or I'm talking about the way somebody else is constructing the black experience or the black church, and then we see that we have multiple constructions of these labels rather than them pointing to some.
Because it happened in the workshop the other day that Miranda and Craig and I were at, that some, you know, I went, the first time I mentioned when I gave the talk, I said African-American religion, the African-American male, and the crowd said, well, you know, it's African-American religions.
Right.
So he wanted to know which one I was referencing. So he could figure out maybe, perhaps, which one, you know, what part of my critique or what I'm saying to disregard and say that doesn't apply to this group over here.
How far would he take that? Because there's a lot of Africas.
Oh, yes.
There's a lot of African-Americans, and now there's a lot, like, how many plurals do we need?
Americans.
Like, where's the nuance end, right?
I think it depends on what point he wants to make, or what
right.
point she wants
right.
to make.
Well, that's the
so chain. It'll be a chain, depending on what they want to be able to skirt around or argue.
In that sense, I mean, the proverbial game is not soccer, it's the goalie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the person using them.
My first really self-conscious interest in the category authenticity, speaking of Africa, came from the 2000 International Association for the History of Religions meeting in Durban. And the manner, for my first time on that continent, and the manner in which a number of people were celebrating this kind of, their travel there as kind of a return to origins, whether they themselves might have come from there or not, you know. And thus, this kind of essentialized identity that they presume to see everywhere around them. Oh, did you see this? Oh, did you see that? And it was the first time that I really started to mull over, and I ended up writing an essay on it, the manner in which every reference, a lot of references, I don't know how far I'll go on that, to an interior disposition, a universal state, etc., thus the category experience that Craig and I have, and with Leslie's help, have been working on, the manner in which it was serving a purpose of power and, you know, not coercion, I guess, power and persuasion, to limit that economy of many Africas. Because in the empirical world, it seems that there's a whole bunch of them, you know, from Morocco to... And that was the first time I think I really started thinking of it as a point, obviously and easily applicable to my own family, to my university, to but you know, back to making the strange familiar and the familiar strange, as we all say. It really did take a trip there, where everything was new to me, and everything was equally new and different. But bumping into people who kept saying, "Oh, did you see this?" Because that's the real Africa. I had a gentleman teach me the way real Africans shake hands.
Wow.
Which was obviously in contest to some other gentleman who looked a little differently and had probably shaken my hand. And it was kind of an interesting lesson of why we do comparative work in new settings.
Mm-hmm.